This week on Art of the Air features the premier dressage horse trainer in the Midwest, Mario A. Contreras. Next, scrimshaw artist and painter Roger Van Boxtel discussing this unique art form developed by New England whalers. Our spotlight's in the 2026 Michigan City Chamber Music Festival, running August 8th through the 16th with its founder, Nick Obovich.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today. Stay in the know. Art on the air, our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart.
Welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, WVLP 103.1 FM, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Art on the Air is on Lakeshore Public Media and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Also heard on Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at WVLP.org. Our spotlight interviews are all Wednesdays on available at our website. Information about Art on the Air is available at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our show is available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for information about upcoming shows and interviews. We'd like to welcome back to Art in the Air Spotlight from the Michigan City Chamber Festival coming up again. And he's going to talk about Nick Obovich. And he's the, I guess you might say, the executive director and coordinator and director of the event. And they have the event coming up this year, August 8th through 16th, and on a variety of locations. Nick, welcome back to Art in the Air Spotlight.
Thank you, Larry. Thank you so much for having me again.
Yeah, it's always wonderful to see you.
Thank you, Esther.
Well, tell us about it. Now, I noticed this year that you're most of the time you're in the same venue at the First Presbyterian Church, but there are times you have things with youth concerts. But go ahead and give us a rundown on what you have starting with on your 25th year of doing this with your first event.
That's right. It is the 25th anniversary of the Michigan City Chamber Music Festival. I am a co-founder and artistic director and a violinist in that organization. This year, for our 25th anniversary, I think appropriately, we have programs that kind of flash back to some of our greatest moments over the 25 years that we've had, and at the same time, looking forward with some new music that's been composed just in the last several years. And we will have a couple of the composers present to talk about their pieces. So we start off by kind of showing off our musicians, our great Grammy nominees, Emmy Award winners, you know, in solos. You know, we're accompanying them. It's going to be a very flashy, virtuosic night. Monday night, we have what we call the Natural World. And that's a great program of music inspired by nature. We have two children's programs. And Larry, as you alluded to, not at First Presbyterian Church, but at the Michigan City Public Library. One all about the trout, which we will have performed the night before, this grand quintet, and also a song based on that by Franz Schubert. Fantastic stuff. It's going to talk to children and young people about our natural world, especially our cold, clear, you know, creeks around that are filled with trout, you know, and other wonderful fish and amphibious life forms. Wednesday night is all Beethoven. We've played a lot of Beethoven over the 25 years. And this night, we're going to premiere a piece that we have never performed before in our 25 years, an unusual piece for two French horns and string quartet. And it's a string piece, yeah, that doesn't get performed much. And I don't know why, but we're going to present that. Friday night is Witness and Legacy, I think a very important concert. We're going to feature pieces by, you know, African-American composers that night, including one that myself and Sophia Glashauser, our other violinist, used to teach. And now she is a rising star in the composition world. She's won major events in Paris, and she has a piece for us that night. We're going to play a piece by Andre Previn that uses the poetry of Toni Morrison, you know, a very important poet of the latter 20th century. And then music that alludes to jazz by our pianist, Robert Aller. And then finally, Dmitri Shostakovich's monumental string quartet number 8 about the struggles of living in Soviet Russia. The final concert, then there's another children's concert, a wonderful concert where Jasmine Arakawa, our pianist, and Sunny, my wife, Sunny Gardner-Orbovich, our education director and co-founder of the festival 25 years ago along with me, have put together an original program, just like the Trout program, about kind of about immigration and travel, traveling up from Argentina all the way through South America, Central America, Mexico, coming up to the United States, as Jasmine, who was born in Japan, but grew up in Venezuela. She is a specialist in Latin style music, and she has music to go along with this original script about a young person traveling through the Americas. And then we have one more concert after that, and I'd like to remind everybody, all these concerts are free of charge. There is no ticket reservation required. And this concert, our old friend Rudolf Hocken, playing an 8-string electric viola, will join us. And then grand music of Johannes Brahms to end our first 25 years before we look ahead to the next. And that quickly rather sums up.
What a dynamic festival again. You know, the Immortal Beethoven was a huge success when you first did it. It was like a phenomenal success. So what a good choice to bring that back. And with Witness and Legacy, is the poem going to be read?
Yes. Well, we're going to have the poems available on print.
Perfect.
And the poems are sung in original English, you know, so I think, you know, it'll be very presentable to the audience.
Beautiful. Thank you.
We have 1 minute left. Well, one thing you mentioned, since the concerts are free, you are always looking for underwriters and sponsorships. So can they contact you for that?
Absolutely. And the easiest way is on our website, mccmf.org. Again, mccmf.org. And there is a donate link right at the top of the page. And it takes you, you can donate either electronically with a credit card. You can donate the old, good old-fashioned way by sending in a check to the address provided on that page. It's very easy.
Excellent. Well, we appreciate you coming back on Art in the Air Spotlight and sharing this. Again, it's the 226th Chamber Music Festival, August 8th through the 16th. Looking back and looking forward, it's our 25th year. You can find out details at that website, mccmf.org. And Nick, thank you so much for coming on Art in the Air Spotlight, sharing about the wonderful, and thank you for such a great contribution to our community.
Oh, thank you, guys. Thanks for having me again. Have a great day, Larry and Esther.
Yeah, you're the best. Thank you, Nick.
Bye-bye.
Art on the Air is brought to you by Ember Forge Consulting, with end-to-end expertise in learning strategy, design, and implementation. Ember Forge turns your organization's knowledge into impact. To learn more, visit emberforgeconsulting.com. And as a reminder, if you'd like to have your event on Art on the Air Spotlight or have a longer feature interview, email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com.
This is Valerie Friedland, author of Why We Talk Funny, and you're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media and on WVLP 103.1 FM.
We are pleased to welcome Mario Contreras to Art on the Air. Mario is an award-winning third-generation master horse trainer born in Texcoco, Mexico, and raised in a family rooted in Alta Escuela. He came to the U.S. in 1990. Mario is a phenomenal premier horse trainer. MC Horse Training is his business. His training facility is The Gate at 45W in Maple Park, Illinois. Mario has been with Medieval Times for over 35 years, 29 of them as head trainer. His unique training methods allow him to train with both horse and rider to perform in all aspects of the 11th century reenactments of fearless knights and dazzling horsemanship. Mario has the talent and skill to bring out the best in each individual horse and rider. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Mario. It's really, really wonderful meeting you.
It's a pleasure to be here with you. Thank you so much.
Well, Mario, our audience always wants to know the background of our guests, though you already have a little bit of it there with Esther's introduction. But we want to hear it from you, your origin story, how you got from where you were to where you are now. So tell us all about Mario.
Well, my father, you know, he was the second generation of horse trainers in his family. And I started riding with him at the barn since I was 4 years old. So I got my first pony and I started riding with him. And then, of course, you know, through time, and when I was younger, I just did it for fun and everything at the barn. We took care of the horses. We have pretty much every animal that you can think of at the barn. We have goats, pigs, chickens, rabbits, you name it. But all horses always been in our family in. You know, it's always been my passion since I was a little kid. My family also, we have a couple singers in the family. So I used to sing as well. But when I came to the U.S., I leaned into the horse training. I had the opportunity to go with my brother when I first arrived to the U.S. And especially in California, in Buena Park for medieval times. And then that's when I continued to work with horses. So after that, you know, I never left horses and I continue up to date doing what I do and what I love the most.
So with your father, that was your intro to training. So not only did you ride with him, but you, I'm sure, picked up generational family techniques.
That is correct. My dad worked for one of the biggest Andalusian breeding farm in Mexico, Casa Pedro Domecq, and it was owned by Don Antonio Ariza Canadilla. Don Antonio Ariza, actually, he was the founder and the producer of Mexico having our own breed in Mexico, the Raza Azteca. I don't know if you remember back in the day, Brandy Presidente, the Brandy, and Don Pedro, those were two brandies that were promoted in Mexico. And Don Antonio used to promote that by taking a horse show with Andalusian stallions all over the country. And every time he had an opportunity, he used to give free breedings to pretty much anyone who had a Criollo mare or a Coro horse mare. And as long as, of course, they were in good condition and healthy and they have all the paperwork in line. And that's why right now in Mexico, we have our own breeding, you know, the Aztecas. So my father had the opportunity to be the founder of that show in 1968. And and he was the first generation to go to start that show. So after that, of course, that show is still going strong right nowadays. But of course, my father passed away 2 years ago, 96 years old. So he was even, you know, up to, you know, a few years ago, my father used to still go to the barn and help out and everything. So it's in our blood. It's in our blood. And I cannot thank him enough for all he did, you know, for us, our family, myself. And I continue that tradition. I love to train horses. I love to train people. And of course, you know, it's a lot easier when you have horses that are gifted and riders that are, you know, very involved into learning, you know, our techniques.
Mm-hmm. So are you, is the fourth and fifth generation being trained in the Contreras family?
That is correct. My nephews, my nephew, Javier Ortiz, Francisco Javier Ortiz, which is my brother's son, Trino, my brother, he worked for that show for Casa Pedro Domecq for more than 40 years. And now he's retired, as well as my brother Marcial, who worked for Medieval Times for almost 22 years as well. And his son, Marcialito Jr., he continues with that tradition. He has also his own barn and training facility in Dallas, Texas.
Now, I don't know if people know what dressage is. You know, they see the name and everything like that. So maybe explain that. I have a granddaughter who runs a horse ranch. She just actually started called Triumph Horses. Now, it's in Texas, so it's much more rodeo-oriented, but she raises horses, trains them, breeds mm-hmm. them, and everything. I mean, they just started this the last few years. So she's in her 20s, but it's become a kind of a family business. But what she's doing, it sounds completely, well, not completely different, but somewhat different than what you're doing. So tell us about what that is.
Yeah, so give you a little bit of my background besides dressage. I started more with high school. High school will be Alta Escuela. Alta Escuela, the difference between Alta Escuela and dressage and high school, Alta Escuela comes from, if you notice, I don't know if you are aware, but the schools of, for example, the one in Jerez in Spain, Spanish writing school, the school in Portugal, the school in France, they all do Alta Escuela, which is dressage. But the difference is in Alta Escuela and dressage that in Alta Escuela, they do the airs above the ground. And dressage, of course, it's dressage. It's like riding with precision, riding with rhythm, with relaxation. You have to be extremely connected with the horse. It's like, I don't know if you like any type of dancing, but it's very important that we dance the same, I don't know, let's say salsa, which is very popular. So, but it's like doing ballet, but doing ballet in a way that it takes years to develop, but doing it properly, you know, and that's, to me, that's what is amazing, you know, dancing with your horse. And it's literally dancing with your horse, because the horse has to be so in tune with you that if you ask him to do, I don't know, for example, in the Grand Prix, you do six strikes and a lateral work and prepare for the change. And it has to be six strikes. Otherwise, of course, you get a bad note on competition. But that's, you know, to get to those levels, you have to practice and rehearsal until things start coming along, you know, riding with elasticity, with relaxation, and have a really good connection. And the horse has to have a really good understanding what you're saying through your body. And that's probably the most difficult thing. We were just talking about earlier with some of my students that one of the hardest things to teach when you ride pretty much any horse at any discipline, it's riding with sensitivity and feeling. You know, that's actually the hardest things to transmit. So in few words, dressage, it's having that connection and having that sensitivity to connect with the horse. To, you know, a lot of people says that you know, the horse doesn't do it and doesn't, well, I feel like the horses don't do what you want them to do, most of them, because they don't understand. You still haven't really explained to them what the little pressure with the leg means. That is right. But once they understand, it's a great feeling. It's a connection. Kind of like when you talk to somebody and you connect with them in a way that like, wow, he does understand. Sometimes most people listen to you to just listen to you. They don't listen to you to understand. And horses, if you don't connect, that's when you have these misunderstandings or these bubbles in the training. So but I always find it...
You have to build confidence and trust. And
that is correct.
What I see when I, you know, when I watch you working with horses, that, I mean, you love them and you let them know. I mean, I could see, like, when you were working with Rio and he would do something and you would say, oh, such a good boy, and pat him. There was so much love that you were building confidence and trust between him. I mean,
you have to. Yeah. And then I think having that sense of making the right, making the question and the horse, when he answers correctly, that's when you praise. And sometimes, you know, praising is not just saying good boys, it's like taking the pressure off. or having given him a break. Those little things that you do, a lot of people doesn't see that and doesn't really understand. But when you are in tune with the horse and you ask him, for example, if you just want him to, a lot of people nowadays, for example, I get a lot of people that wants me to teach him how to teach a horse how to piaf. Forget about breaking him and the usual, let's put the saddle on and putting the bridle on for the first time. I say, how do you teach him how to piaf? Or how do you teach him to Spanish walk? Or, well, it's very simple, but it takes a long time. And you have to be extremely patient, you know. You just put, like, for example, if we're going to teach a horse how to piaf, you put him along the wall, and then you make sure that you kind of, the horse understand that he needs to be like in a little box, you know, between the wall, your left hand in the front, yourself on the right side. And then the long whip, which is a 5 foot or a 6 foot, helps you to keep the back end from going backwards. So you, in a few words, you kind of box him in a little bit, making sure that horse is comfortable for that. And to me, groundwork is always one of the most important aspects of training. A lot of people, you know, find it boring or want to skip that part. But if you do that from the ground, when the horse learns to do all kinds of stuff without a rider and all that stuff, I feel that they understand faster and it's a lot easier for them to capture. So if I want them to, if I wanted to teach, for example, piaf or Spanish walk, I start with one leg. I just touch them with the whip until I get a reaction. And sometimes the reaction, by the natural reaction, when you tap, for example, the inside hind, the hind left, the natural reaction will be to pick up the leg or to kick. A natural reaction. But eventually you teach them to pick it up and hold it, and then, you know, be patient until they figure it out what you really want. And then you do one leg at a time, and eventually you put it together. And then it's beautiful, because you're going to say, how in the heck did you teach the horse to do that with a little whip? And then it's been only like a month or two. Well, horses are very smart, but you have to, some horses are, of course, more intelligent than others. Some horses are more sensitive than others. But more than anything, you got to train the brain to try to figure it out what you want. So you have to be super quick to give that reward when they do what you're looking for. But the most important part is that you have to know what you want. I always say my little example that I said, okay, listen, let's say that I invite you to, I'm going to cook for you. I'm the cook, and I'm gonna make the best taco you ever had. Well, in your mind, you already know what a taco is, and you already know what you like. But at the end of the day, you're not going to like the same way I do. I like it with, the tortilla has to be the basics. The tortilla has to be warm. The meat has to be medium well. And not a lot of people likes the same. So everybody has a different concept how it should be like. So same thing with the horses. You know, sometimes just to hold the reins, I suggest contact. And sometimes they're jenking on the horse's mouth. Or sometimes the horses, the reins are extremely loose, that there is no contact or connection to communicate with the horse. So that's one of the hardest things to really get to. But once you understand, and through repetitions, that's why, you know, just holding the rein and teaching them, okay, this is how it should feel like. And then eventually to get to that point, and sometimes you get it for a few seconds, or you get it for a half a circle. And that's when sometimes as a coach, you say, do you feel that? Can you feel that? And then sometimes they don't even know that it's happening. And sometimes like, yes. And then they lose it for another two or three circles, or maybe for a day or two, until you're like, okay, we need to do what you created the other day. But it takes a while, and takes a lot of repetitions. But the most important part is that mentally, that I think not just physically, you have to be super strong, but you have to be mentally be able to understand that, because I feel like most riders sometimes they don't reach their goal because they get frustrated, they get angry, they start getting personal. No, take it easy. You'll get there. But sometimes it takes a little bit longer. Sometimes it takes another circle, another day, another week, sometimes another month, you know. But at the end of the day, you have to have that. You have to be extremely positive. And I think that's the beauty with horses. You know, they make you so confident. They make you so, they have taught me a lot of patience. When I was younger, you know, it was, I wanted to have everything fast and everything. And, you know, my dad is like, no, take it easy. You'll get there, but nice and easy. But, you know, there is a lot of lessons and sometimes things or words that will stick to your head for life because they are legit. They are what you really need to maintain throughout your life to keep going and to keep growing. To me, I'm one of the trainers that I always feel that it's always important to continue to learn, to continue with education, to take lessons, to go to clinics, to go to seminars where, you know, sometimes you're like, wow, I like that exercise and let me try it with this horse. And sometimes it really works. And sometimes you're like, you know what, this doesn't work for this horse. So, you know, when you train with different people and when you go to different places, you learn so much. And then educating yourself, not just, you know, feeling, but by looking, sometimes having a good eye is important.
You know, I was going to ask you, first of all, about breeds of horses, if there's certain breeds of horses that are better for this type of work and other. But you also touched on something else, and so this is kind of a two-part question, is about the personality horse each one has, but also does that match the rider? Like, are there some incompatibility between a certain rider and a certain horse? But also, what breeds work better with the dressage and what you do?
Well, you know what? Myself, personally, I love Andalusians. I grew up riding Andalusians my whole life. But, you know, when I came here to the U.S., I started working for pretty much any type of horses. Andalusians, in my mind, and, you know, they're easy to train. They're not just beautiful to look at. They are really good movers. They also have, their minds are easy to work with. I have work with other breeds like Warmbloods, where you see some horses move and they move phenomenal. They are like, you know, they are super elastic. They are floaty. They are, but sometimes they are really hard to work with because they are a little, their mind is a little, it's a little, they're super sensitive, you know, and they, you have to really build that trust. But once you do, you're like, wow, these horses, that's why they are so competitive on dressage, because they not just move, they're, I feel like sometimes they are breed or they're bred more for movement, but at the same time, you know, once you get to figure them out and really understand, you know, they're really nice to work with. But in the beginning, it was very hard because they were not as willing. They were not as easy like Andalusians, let's say. You know, sometimes, you know, people buy these horses, and that's where we go into the, is this horse a match for this person? Well, you know, personally, I like horses that are sensitive, and a lot of people like horses that are very, you know, that you can make a mistake or you can put your leg on and they don't say anything. They don't make a big deal. They're extremely forgiving, which is fine. But as a person or as a rider, when you're going to buy a horse or when you're going to try a horse to ride, I think to me, it's always, it's important to really find a match, because I usually myself, I train riders and a schoolmaster and a horse that is very easy, that already has many miles and really understands. And that teaches these new riders to become great riders in the future. Once these riders become really good, and then I start teaching those good riders into horses that are greener. And that's how I make extremely exceptional riders. And to me, that's, you know, one of the most important things in life as a trainer and coach, that when you train riders and different horses will make them really good. And right now I have some of my students, Jill Heisler, Blake Dutzig, Jesse Hackenberg, a few riders that right now they're doing phenomenal and they're doing really good. From these are people that, you know, they were really green riders and they are doing really well with Meetable Times. I have produced several trainers throughout the company. Javier Ortiz, Amanda Kenny, Felipe Ramirez. You know, there is a few riders that, you know, they started with me just mocking stalls, just cleaning stalls. But when I see sometimes, you know, it's like anything, the passion that they have, and eventually it's not just the passion, you know, it's the talent and it's the work ethic. You combine all these things together and then you can say, wow, look at this guy. I wish I could ride like this in this short period of time, because they're extremely talented. So, but you know, at the end of the day, that's up to, it's up to you to continue to follow and continue with your education. And I think it's important to continue to keep learning, because each horse, I think the best teachers are the horses. And as long as you can, that you develop this sensitivity in a way that you can understand them. You know, I get a lot of horses. Sometimes they, when they, before they bring them to me, they paint this picture that they are so bad and they're so this and that. And then, you know what? These horses, once they bring them to me and then I work with them, well, they are misunderstood. They don't really click with them. They don't really read what the problem is. And sometimes you have to go back to basics a little bit to really, you know what? Why don't you start from the beginning? Let's just start from the beginning and let's explain to them what we want from them. What are the expectations? And then you kind of, you open a whole new, you know, atmosphere where you start seeing the horse to having a great time. That's the horse starting to be happy about it. And then everything goes from there. And it's a really great feeling.
Yeah, they need to learn the alphabet before they can read. And so,
that is correct. That is great. You couldn't say it better. That's right.
And you need that connection too. Just like you say, if you're mucking the stalls, it's an important connection to the horse you're building when you're washing him, when you're brushing him, when you're, you know.
That is correct.
Being around him. So there's nothing wrong with mucking stalls.
No, not at all. Not at all. I think when you are all around rider, you got to be able to do pretty much anything around them. And, you know, sometimes just mucking is very relaxing. Just grooming a horse. You bond with a horse. There is so many things. But at the end of the day, going back to basics, it's crucial to restart if it's necessary.
You know, Mario, we just have a few moments left. We want to give you the opportunity to how people can reach out to you and find you online and get in contact.
Well, you know, if you can follow me on Facebook, Instagram, on Facebook, Mario A. Contreras, and it's connected to my Instagram. We just started a TikTok, you know, doing little videos here and there. That would be great. So thank you so much for the opportunity. It's a pleasure to be here with you guys.
We appreciate you coming on Art of the Air and sharing what a wonderful and fascinating journey. And we'll have your picture online. Click on it and it will take you right to, we'll make it your Facebook page. Mario A. Contreras on Art of the Air. Thank you so much for sharing your journey.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you. What you do is amazing.
Thank you. I can't wait for you to come and join us and see our show at Meetable Times here in Chicago, and come to the gate and see our training facility for MC Horse Training LLC.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Art of the Air listeners, do you have a suggestion for a possible guest on our show? Whether it's an artist, musician, author, gallery, theater, concert, or some other artistic endeavor that you are aware of, or a topic of interest to our listeners, email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com.
This is Clay Jenkinson for Listening to America, and you are listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media and WVLP 103.1 FM.
We are happy to welcome Roger Van Boxtel to Art on the Air. Roger visited the island of Maui and was introduced to the art of scrimshaw. It is the folk art of etching figures and scenes on ivory and bones. Originally, Roger's art was done on ivory piano keys, but with government regulations, he switched to acrylic piano keys. The subject of his works vary: flowers, churches, butterflies, insects, historical locations, bridges, lighthouses, and waterways, just to name a few. He adds color using oil paints, and he also beautifully mats and frames his own work. Since 2006, he has sold 5,620 frame pieces and repurposed 28,438 piano keys. Pope Francis and Sir Elton John currently have pieces of his work, and Ripley's, believe it or not, purchased some of his work for display in multiple locations due to the number of keys he has repurposed. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Roger. It's very, very wonderful meeting you.
Same here.
Roger, our first question usually is our audience wants to know your origin story, and I always set it up by saying how you got from where you were to where you are now. So tell us all about Roger.
Okay. I was born and raised in Little Chute, Wisconsin, which is about 25 miles south of Green Bay. Went to grade school there and attended high school in Kimberly, Wisconsin, which is across the Fox River from Little Chute. I graduated from high school in 1955. And because of my strength in art, my art teacher in high school convinced me to go to Layton School of Art in Milwaukee. I went there for a couple of years, and after that, I went to work for a chain of department stores in Appleton, which was the H.C. Prainy Company. I went there to work in the display department and the window trimming. I did that for about a year and a half, and then I got called into the military, where I served in the medics. And coming out of the military, I returned to the same group of department stores and worked for them, and I continued to work for them, only I didn't work in the display department. I started getting into the retail end of the business in home furnishings. And I did that in quite a few different levels of management and locations. I did that for as long as I worked for them, which I put 45 years in the column.
Wow.
Yeah, it is a long time, isn't it?
It is. It's a very long time. It's beautiful. They must have been a very fair company for you to stay loyal for so long.
Yeah, they were. And all those years, I have to say that I always stayed active with art.
So what were you doing?
Back then, I was doing watercolors and oil paintings. And my wife, Verla, and our three children, Brutal, art shows every weekend, and they just love doing it. The extra ink is always good too.
So is that what in school, is that what they noticed was your drawing and painting ability, or were
all through grade school and all through high school. And I also had a real interest in music. When I was in high school, I played with bands, and after I got out of high school, I played for quite a few years to different bands.
What did you play? What instrument did you play?
Saxophone and clarinet.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Which saxophone?
Alto.
Alto? Okay.
I also had a tenor, which I didn't play much.
I know. You tend to collect saxophones as you go along. I know my daughter has both a tenor and an alto, and then she also played a baritone she didn't own the baritone, but she played it with a ska band. So, yeah, you tend to move around from the woodwinds.
So what was your household like growing up? Were your parents artistic? Is that where, or maybe grandparents?
No, they really weren't. I was the only one in the family that was that way.
Can you describe what art classes were in the 50s then?
Oh, heavens. They're actually pretty, art classes, my high school classes were all very serious. A lot of competition and contests and with the state and everything. And I was very involved with art. I just loved it. My brother was just the opposite. He was into mechanics and cars. He ended in the Air Force as a jet mechanic.
Yeah, they both require intense intense dedication.
Yeah. My dad was a very creative person, though. He'd make something out of nothing. He was a good man that way. And he encouraged it, art.
So tell us a little bit about the history of the art at Scrimshaw, how that came about, what materials they used and everything. I mean, people probably, they might be familiar with the end product, but they may not understand the whole history of that. I'm sure you can enlighten us about that.
Yeah, a lot of people don't even know what Scrimshaw is right now. Anyhow, Scrimshaw started like in the early 1800s, and it was an engraving done on normally bone and ivory. And it was commonly, the sperm whale bones and teeth were commonly used for it. And after they would etch a design on this, first of all, they did this during the break boredom. Because when sailing winds weren't up and the ships were idle, they couldn't go look for whales. These guys had to do something. And some of these fellas went out on these ships out of New England area. They'd be out on the water for a year, 2 years, 3 years before they went home, with a whole load of blubber oil for lamps and oil. And they just had to do something. So they would scratch on this ivory, and they would rub lampblack into the scratch marks, or soot or tobacco juice to make this design show up. And they did the scratching with sail needles that they sewed sails with, jackknives, very crude. But they would do this on the ships during this free time to bring his gifts back home. And it all started because of boredom, just doing nothing on a ship for many, many days at a time.
So when you were on Maui, what were the first Scrimshaw pieces you saw and what were the next steps you took? I mean, was it right away a connection that I want to try this?
Yeah, there's a, my wife and I went to Maui starting in 1991. We went for 17 years in a row and got some good friends there. And one of my good friends was, he worked for a Scrimshaw shop. And he saw my art and he liked my art. He thought I had good art, but he thought I ought to really give a try at Scrimshaw. So he gave me a artificial plastic whalebone with a scratching tool and some instructions. And I took that home back to home here on the mainland. And then a year later, I start scratching on this ivory and I glued it up on boards like a canvas. And I took a batch back to Maui the next year. And I sold it there. But then when I got there, I tried to find someone that wanted to put it on permanently all week long and all year long. And her name was Robin Ritchie. And she had a little gift shop, a gallery shop across from the Banyan Tree, the visitor bureau on the island of Maui.
In Lahaina, right?
In Lahaina, yeah. She was between the Banyan Tree and the street and the visitor center. And she took it on. And from that point on, everything just skyrocketed for me. I just couldn't keep up putting up, producing work for her. She produced hundreds, sold hundreds of pieces of my work a year.
Yeah, she's quite dynamic.
Yeah, she really was. Did you know? You didn't know her, did
no,
you?
No, but we had a lovely phone conversation.
Yeah, she was really an active person in Hawaii. She's originally from Vancouver, Canada.
So the pieces that you brought back from Wisconsin to Maui, were they of Maui scenes?
They were all Maui scenes, and I loved doing them. A lot of palm trees, a lot of flowers, a lot of ships, sailing ships. And they're all different sizes. Some were like 5 keys, some were like 40 keys. She had no trouble selling. She is a professional salesperson.
Well, and, so are you. I mean, like.
She was really just a really professional salesperson and really understood art.
Yeah.
Well, I was very lucky to find her.
So the pieces, those first pieces that you brought over, had you started to use the oil paints on them?
No, I didn't. No, she encouraged me later on to try to put color on them. And I didn't put the oils on heavy. I kind of had left them transparent. But once I started putting the oil paint on, they really took off.
That's so interesting because they do, because I do have a piece that I treasure. They have a quality of a watercolor.
Yeah, they do. I try to keep it that way. So I didn't want to block out the ivory itself.
Right. So. The colors are beautiful.
Yeah. With having done over 5,000 pieces, do you have a favorite, let's say one, but I mean, or subject of one that you like to do? I like to do. So is there a favorite, you know, subject that you like to do?
Oh, flowers. And I used to love to do whaling ships.
Ah.
Whaling scenes.
Do you know, one of my favorite pieces is the musical note ones that you did for The Last Supper?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a beautiful piece. Can you describe how that happened?
That happened through Robin, the person that was I'm trying to remember his name right now. And, oh, God. Anyhow, he's out of Los Angeles, and he was a curator. He put together a Leonardo da Vinci show that traveled through the United States that had 60 pieces of machinery that da Vinci drew plans for, and they built it and it went around the world. And these keys I did were the last they found in The Last Supper when they repainted the scenery on the ceiling. They found this music scale up there. So they figured Da Vinci also was into music. So they called The Last Supper a requiem. And they asked me to do that, those scales on some keys that went along with this show around the world.
Oh, so beautiful.
And there was an article in the Maui paper, and it was a huge article they put out there for me in the Lahaina. And I think it was Lahaina News at the time.
So where is the piece now?
I have no idea where that one is. So this fellow that planted some. I'm trying to think of his name, and I cannot think of his name. I was producing work for him for his. It was in a gallery, a museum, a historical museum, and they were selling some of my stuff there.
And after a brief pause, we'll return to our guest today on Art on the Air.
This is Manoush Zomorodi, host of NPR's TED Radio Hour, and you are listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media and on WVLP 103.1 FM.
And now we return to our guest on Art on the Air. So when you're working, you work with something other than piano keys? I mean, I realize you're using acrylic ones, but do you work on any kind of larger medium to create anything?
Wait, what?
Do you work with a larger medium to do scrimshine? I mean, or do you just do piano keys as your source?
Just piano keys right now. I mean, that's the only form of ivory I could get at the time.
Sure.
Was the piano keys. And now I, of course, got away from all the ivory, actually, because during the Obama administration, they outlawed ivory. If you couldn't prove a certain age old, you couldn't use it.
Right.
So all these old pianos that would be throwing out everything, I can't use that stuff anymore. I won't use it. I'm sitting on about 600-700 keys right now in ivory that I can't use here, which I picked up all over the country at different piano tuner people that repaired pianos. I picked this stuff all over the United States when we go on vacations and everything. Stop at these shops and they'd give them to me. They had boxes of them that took off old pianos.
Right.
So.
Find any difference using the ivory as opposed to the acrylic? Do you have to work any differently?
No, the acrylic scratches a little easier than the ivory did.
Yeah.
Which is really a blessing for me because I'm starting to get arthritis in my hands a little bit. And the public really don't seem to mind the difference between the acrylic ones. There's a lot of old acrylic around. It's been on the market since the 30s. And you can't tell the difference when you look at them. It's almost impossible to tell the difference when you see the old ivories and the old acrylics.
So besides scrimshaw, do you like to go back to doing some of your other art painting? Or have you just kind of gone down this path of scrimshaw only?
I've been so busy with it that I just haven't had time. I really would enjoy going back to oils a little bit. But I'm 90 years old right now, so my time is kind of running out.
But you may want to fulfill something. There might be something. Well, and that brings me to the other question. Is there some kind of art that you haven't done that you would like to do or some other, you kind of mastered this whole thing. You've, of course, mastered oils and stuff earlier. Is there something that's like, gee, I wish I could do. Is there something you want to do?
No, there isn't. I did wood carving. I carved totem poles. I built model ships for the shipyards. And I kind of did a little bit of everything. We got a big shipyard here at Sturgeon Bay that built naval ships.
Right.
And I worked on some models for them. And I also worked on models for a Duval Steel Ship Corporation in Pine Bluff, Arkansas, patrol craft. They'd have to build the models before they built the ship. And they'd give me the blueprints and I'd build them. That was another thing I had going for quite a while. So,
did any of your children take an artistic path?
No. My son is good at it. He helped me out with scrimshaw. He can do it. But he's a mechanic right now, and he's very, very busy.
So what's on your table now? What are you working on?
I just have to redo some stuff for Woodwalk Gallery. They sold all 5 pieces and just sent me a list. They wanted me to redo the 5 pieces.
Oh, wow.
They send me this monthly, they do so.
Well, the work is just so beautiful, Roger.
And you know, I do all that work pretty much in the wintertime when there's nothing to do here in Wisconsin. I'll produce all this work and drop it off in the spring to them. And they'll feed in a little bit through the summer yet. So, but I don't mind doing it in the winter. Summertime, I don't care to sit in the house too much and do too much of it.
Right. Well, what do you do like for fun, like in Wisconsin, if you're not scrimshawing, when you're indoors in the cold weather, what else do you like to do? Going outdoors or doing something?
I like fishing. I spend a lot of time in Door County. My daughter has got a home up there. So Door County is a beautiful area.
It is beautiful.
Oh, you're familiar with it, huh?
Right. Yeah. And it's a very artistic community.
Yeah, it is. But I go up there quite a bit in the summertime.
So if it's not giving away any trade secrets, what are you using to create the black line?
I use a regular scratching tool that's engravers use for scratching metal.
No, I mean the black. Are you using soot
paint.
Or?
I use oil paint.
Oil paint for the black?
Yeah, I'm not. No, I'm not into soot and all that.
No soot or tobacco juice, huh?
Yeah, I'm trying to find the color I use here. I think I use raw sienna. I think it is. I rub into it.
Oh, nice.
Raw umber.
Raw umber? Yeah, that's...
Dark brown.
Dark brown.
It looks black when it's in the grooves.
It does.
Much more permanent than other means, too. The oil paint is very permanent. And I have to wait a day or so for it to dry before I actually paint them then.
Yeah, completely.
Now, yeah. You do your own framing on top of this. So, I mean, you take care of the matting and framing on your own when you put these pieces together.
Yep. And I did that for a good part of my life. I was in the framing business on the side also.
And, you know, he uses such a high quality mat and frame. You know, my piece looks like the mat is suede, a beautiful suede. The mat is gorgeous. And the extra details you put on the mat, it just, oh gosh, it's so beautiful.
Yeah, that mat board's getting very expensive. It comes from the Netherlands.
It's gorgeous.
And that's all I've ever used on them. And the reason I use it is because I glue the keys down to it, and the keys hold a lot better on that nap finish than on a flat mat board. So it's hard to get them off once the glue dries, but on a regular mat board, you can pop them off pretty easy.
Right.
So my under background is always that suede.
Yep. Yeah, it's beautiful. I mean, it all just works so, I mean, it's just perfectly framed and matted.
And frankly, looking at the prices of the pieces, they are so reasonably priced. I cannot believe, I'm scanning the website right now, and I mean, these are, for the amount of work that goes into it and the framing and everything,
yeah.
These are wonderfully inexpensive, but just such quality for, you know, it's amazing. I'm just scanning through the different things, and they're just, you know, it's such a great variety.
Yeah, I got to the point where I can do these fairly fast. I'm really fast at framing right now. And that's one advantage I have over a lot of other people where I do my own, because framing is very costly to have done. So
it is very costly.
Yep, yep.
And especially using the materials that you use on yours, they're extra expensive.
Yeah. I know that's why in my photography I've gone to gallery wraps without frames. The other reason is when you exhibit with frames many times, they come back and your frames eventually get dinged up, and it's like, you know, from just exhibiting. So gallery wraps, you know, there's no frame to ding. You're just like, there it is. And so everything. But what else do you have planned to do? I mean, is there a subject that you haven't covered that you say, you know, I need to do? I mean, you're on sailing ships and butterflies and flowers. Well,
no, there really isn't. I've done most everything. It's a place of what the people want right now. They'll ask me to do things, and I'll just do. And it's pretty much repeats. Just about everything I do right now is a repeat at one time or another.
Right.
When you frame that many pieces, I've done so many things that you can almost go back and copy what you did prior.
So you do commissions. So someone approaches you, you know, I'd really like to have... and they'll do that.
I prefer not to anymore.
Oh, okay.
No, I'm getting to the point where I really don't want to do that anymore.
I understand.
I'm doing as much as I want to do right now, basically. That's what I was afraid of, something like this. I don't hope too much doesn't come.
Well, but they can get directed to the galleries, so.
Well, that's what I would do. I'd direct them to the galleries because they do a good job for me. So.
Do you have any plans to go back to Hawaii and get your inspiration? Or
not really. I just went back about several years ago with my son and daughter once. But no, I haven't really been back there since before the COVID right now. Yeah, Robin, you know, she sold her place right before the COVID hit and the fire at Lahaina. She sold her gallery, and she had that sold before the fire hit there.
Well, that must have been some, that's quite amazing to hear. Lahaina, was completely devastated.
Yeah. And I did a lot of shows underneath that banyan tree, and the banyan tree is living yet.
Wow. It's amazing.
That's the only thing there that is living right now. So, okay.
In our final minute here, we're going to give you a chance to have people, how they can find you online. I know that we'll have your picture where they'll click on it and it'll take you to the Woodwalk Gallery. But tell us about that, or Instagram, or any other things like that.
Okay,
I think just look him up. If you can just Google Roger Van Boxtel, and that's V-A-N, capital B-O-X-T-E-L. That would be a good way to be directed to the galleries and...
Okay, yeah.
Right. Well, that would be the best way. And, of course, the one gallery I'm looking at right now is the woodwalkgallery.com, and you just look you up in as their artist. So, but, Roger, yeah, we'd like to thank you for coming on Art of the Air, sharing your wonderful art journey with our audience and your whole story behind that and making them familiar with what scrimshaw is. It's a kind of a wonderful piece of art and a very, very unique and extraordinarily talented. Thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing your art journey.
Thank you. I was nervous on this one. I've never done this before, and I could have never set this up.
Oh, I just think, you know, this conversation has made me treasure my piece even more. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
We'd like to thank our guests this week on Art on the Air, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. Art on the Air is on Lakeshore Public Media and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Art on the Air is also heard Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at WVLP.org. If you have a smart speaker like Amazon Alexa, Google Assistant, or Apple Siri, just tell to play Art on the Air to hear the latest episode. Our spotlight interviews are on Wednesdays, available at our website. Thanks to Greg Kovach, WVLP's station manager. Our theme music is by Billy Foster with a vocal by Renee Foster. We'd like to thank our current underwriters, Ember Forge Consulting, thoughtful marketing and digital learning built to express your purpose and grow your reach. Learn more at emberforgeconsulting.com/grow. And for WVLP, Walt Breidinger of Paragon Investments. So we may continue to bring you Art in the Air, we rely on you, our listeners and underwriters, for ongoing financial support. If you're looking to support Art on the Air, we have information on our website at breck.com/AOTA, where you can find out how to become a supporter or underwriter of our program in whatever amount you are able. And like I say every week, don't give till it hurts. Give till it feels good. You'll feel so good about supporting Art on the Air. If you're interested in being a guest or sending us information about your arts, arts-related event or exhibit, please email us at AOTA@breck.com. That's AOTA@breck.com. BRECH.com, or contact us through our Facebook page. Your hosts were Larry Breckner and Esther Golden, and we invite you back next week for another episode of Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know. Esther and Larry are on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the Air, our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art.